This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They also start throwing tear gas in people's houses, and that has caused the death of a number of people from suffocation, from tear gas, most of them children.
That's Otsieno Namwaya. The East Africa Director of Human Rights Watch says police in Kenya are abusing their authority, lobbing tear gas at protesters angry over high food prices and tax hikes. Details coming up. Also, Kenyans are seeing more violence today with the start of a planned three-day protest over higher prices and tax hikes. And petroleum consumption has dropped by nearly a third in Nigeria since a fuel subsidy was dropped. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Petroleum fuel consumption has dropped by nearly a third in Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, since President Bola Tinubu in May scrapped an expensive fuel subsidy. Authorities are looking to promote alternative fuels, including converting engines to run on compressed natural gas and expanding electric vehicle charging stations. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Nigerian contractor Friday Awadi runs his fossil fuel-powered generator at least 8 hours a day to mold blocks for construction. Awadi says since opening his business a year ago, the government has stopped paying fuel subsidies and his energy bills have tripled.
We have intention to shut down the business completely because we know that we're going to work and not making any profits. And it's unproductive, very. The consign and all of that, so we started to look for an alternative.
So, Awadi converted his generator to run on liquefied petroleum gas, and his energy cost has dropped to one-third of what it was before.
I realized that the generator run more efficiently, smoother. And that also means that it would allow the system to perform with the optimal performance.
Nigeria was spending hundreds of millions of dollars a month on subsidies to keep fuel affordable at pumps. Government officials say the money saved by ending the program will be used for crucial projects. Meanwhile, Nigeria's petroleum regulatory authorities say that in June, daily petrol consumption fell by 28%. Natural gas is not the only alternative gaining popularity among Nigerians.
This is Nigeria's first assembled electric car. When fully charged, it can cover a distance of around 500 kilometers.
Authorities unveiled the electric car in 2021 and say they plan to expand access to production and use. Jelani Aliu is the Director General of the National Automotive Design and Development Council.
We believe Nigeria is right and the solutions are available to really take advantage of. So the removal of subsidy actually would open up doors and opportunities for these alternative forms of energy.
But Nigerian inventor Reginald Umaru Bamiji says access to charging stations could pose a challenge. Bamiji created an electric car that recharges itself while in motion and says he's talking to authorities about adopting the prototype.
You know, in Africa particularly, the power supply is not there. So even when they build charging stations, where is the power to supply the charging stations? That's the issue. But with this system, globally, we have solved the problem of electric cars.
Earlier in July, President Tinubu announced a handout of $10 a month to poor households to cushion the rising cost of food and transportation. But until there's something more sustainable, many like Awadi are getting inventive to try to get by. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The international group Human Rights Watch has called for the European Union to suspend migration control funding to Tunisia, saying security forces there have committed serious abuses against black African migrants. The New York-based watchdog said today it had interviewed, since March, more than 20 migrants and asylum seekers, almost all of whom reported suffering human rights violations at the hands of Tunisian authorities. Seven were among up to 1,200 black Africans expelled or forcibly transferred by Tunisian security forces to the country's desert border region with Libya and Algeria this month. Correspondents from the French news agency AFP reported Sunday that Libyan border guards rescued dozens of migrants who were visibly exhausted and dehydrated and who said Tunisian authorities had taken them there. The expulsions came as racial tensions flared after a Tunisian man was killed on July 3rd in a clash between locals and migrants in Sfax. Kenyans are seeing more violence today with the start of a planned 3-day protest over higher prices and tax hikes. In the capital, Nairobi, police shut down roads leading to the presidency and businesses in the city center closed. Protesters set bonfires and tried to block traffic, prompting police to lob tear gas at young demonstrators in the streets of Nairobi. At least 27 people have been killed since protests began last month. Otosieno Namwaya is East Africa Director for Human Rights. From Nairobi, he tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that police appear to be abusing their authority, but by firing tear gas and even live bullets at protesters.
My reading of what I've seen across Kenya is that the initial stages of the protests are very peaceful until when police start throwing tear gas at people. And it's the police who then provoke people to start throwing stones. And then police also go further and not just throw tear gas at the protesters. They also start throwing tear gas in people's houses. And that has caused the death of a number of people from suffocation, from tear gas, most of them children, in people's houses because government had urged people to stay indoors. And then people stay indoors and the government throws tear gas in the houses. The police throw tear gas in the houses. Police have also used live bullets, sometimes very unnecessarily. If you look at the protesters, most of the time, if you look at the protesters, who the main protesters on the streets are unarmed. Occasionally, they do throw stones, but government has just been, the police have just been using live bullets, as a result of which I think we have numerous deaths.
Does Human Rights Watch consider this a violation of international law with human rights abuses if police have been using live bullets on protesters?
Definitely. It's a major one because the protesters are not armed and they are not violent until police start provoking them. And then after police provoke them, they shoot them. In other cases, I think police have shot live bullets in people's houses. I saw that in Kisumu. We've seen that in parts of Nairobi like Kibera, Madare, and parts of Kariobangi. And a number of people we documented in March, April, and May were people who were non-protesters. There were protesters, some who died, but majority of those who died were not protesting. And this tells you sometimes it's not the people you hear have died and not necessarily because the government is trying to quell protests. That's because the police go out there and just become reckless. They start throwing tear gas and shooting live bullets in people's houses.
Some officials have said stop the violence. Just recently, the Interior Minister said anyone planning to unleash violence on Kenyans is hereby warned to cease and desist. But you're saying that police are not listening. Is that right?
I don't think they mean it. If they mean it, they will actually make sure that whichever police officer has used excessive force is held to account. But if you look at Kenya's history, there has been violence this year, of course, and the killings during protests have happened this year. They happened in 2020 during Corona, around 27 people. In 2017, there were killings during protests. We documented 104. In 2016, there were killings during protests. We documented about 22. None of those killings is currently or has ever been prosecuted in court and has ever been investigated. Even IPOA, which is meant to investigate the police, has never investigated killings during protests. So it's like police know that when they kill people during protests, they can always get away with it.
And what is Human Rights Watch calling for in Kenya?
The first thing is that the Kenya government needs to recognize and appreciate the right to protest is there and to stop interfering or trying to tamper with the law, which is recognized internationally. Secondly, all the abuses that have happened during protests, including the killings of 2017, the killings of 2020, need to be investigated and taken to court.
That's Atsiono Namawaya, East African Director for Human Rights Watch. He was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Nairobi, Kenya. South Africa announced today that Russian President Vladimir Putin will not attend the summit in person next month, ending controversy over whether Pretoria would arrest him under a warrant from the International Criminal Court. Putin is wanted by the court for alleged war crimes during Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
Pretoria's diplomatic nightmare appears to be over. After months of confusion surrounding Putin's possible travel to South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa's spokesman, Vincent Magwenya, announced the Russian leader won't be attending the meeting of the BRICS group of emerging economies.
By mutual agreement, President Putin of the Russian Federation will not attend the summit. However, Russia will be represented by Foreign Minister Mr. Sergei Lavrov.
The announcement comes a day after it was revealed that Ramaphosa believed arresting Putin, should he set foot in the country, would amount to a declaration of war. South Africa, which is a signatory to the International Criminal Court's Rome Statute, had been looking for possible ways out of acting on the warrant, despite pressure from the political opposition and rights groups to honor its commitment. Mia Swart, a law professor at Johannesburg's Witwatersrand University, told VOA South Africa is now relieved of any obligation to act.
It will not be necessary for the government to go through any of the legal maneuvers they've been considering over the last month, such as even withdrawing from the statute.
She added that the government's announcement shows they realized there was no way of escaping their international obligations.
In some sense, this is a good thing. It means that they take the ICC seriously. And one can read into this that there is no plan to withdraw from the ICC imminently.
Elizabeth Sideropoulos, director of the South African Institute of International Affairs, said that Ramaphosa's argument that arresting Putin would have been seen as a declaration of war by Moscow, which was rejected by South Africa's opposition, was not necessarily incorrect.
And I think that isn't an implausible assumption to make, not only in the case of President Putin, but indeed in the case of any other head of state in any other country, should he or she be arrested or an attempt to arrest them in another country be executed. And certainly Russia would see it that way.
South Africa has been widely criticized by the West for what is perceived as its bias towards Moscow, though the government rejects the allegations and insists it has taken an officially neutral stance on the Ukraine war. Last month, Ramaphosa led a delegation of African leaders to both Ukraine and Russia as part of an unsuccessful peace mission. Foreign Minister Lavrov, who will now be attending the BRICS event alongside Ramaphosa and the leaders of China, Brazil and India, was welcomed to the country on a visit earlier this year, shortly before South Africa hosted Russian warships for controversial joint exercises. Then, in May, the U.S. ambassador to the country made the startling allegation that South Africa also had provided arms to Russia, something the government has denied but says it is investigating. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
As you have heard, Russian President Putin will not attend the BRICS summit in South Africa, ending months of speculation he could be detained for war crimes. The International Criminal Court has issued a warrant that accuses Putin for responsibility for the war crime of unlawful deportation and transfer of Ukrainian children since its invasion, which many rights organizations say are child abductions. I first asked Misha Gutkin, manager editor of the Russian service in our New York bureau, if today's announcement was a slap in the face for the Russian leader.
I think it's a bit of an embarrassment for him. And the reason I say that is because Kremlin spokesperson announced that while President Putin will participate in a summit by video, in person Russia will be represented by Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. And the South African presidency floated this idea that Lavrov represent Russia at the summit in Johannesburg instead of Vladimir Putin. And previously, Russians rejected that. Now they're kind of forced to accept that idea. So they're going back on that rejection. And also because, you know, Russia has claimed that this arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin is null and void, as they say, from a legal perspective, from their point of view. But the events today show that this is not quite so.
Misha, why is the ICC targeting Putin? Could you explain to our audience what the core issue is behind him being wanted by the ICC?
Well, the charges relate to kidnapping of Ukrainian children, abduction and kidnapping of Ukrainian children, and transporting them from Ukraine to Russia. Now, Russia is rejecting these charges, saying that these kids were rescued from war situations, and in some cases they may have lost their parents. And so the Russians are claiming that they're rescuing those kids, but there is some evidence that, in fact, at least some of the children do have their parents alive, and the parents are actively trying to get the children back from Russia and encountering some difficulties doing that. So this is the basis for the charges.
South Africa is the current chair of the BRICS group, a gathering of heavyweights. That also includes Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and which sees itself as a counterweight to Western economic domination. So you mentioned earlier that Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will represent Russia in the BRICS meeting. Will he actually fill in the shoes of Vladimir Putin?
Well, as I mentioned also, Vladimir Putin will participate by video in the proceedings there. I think we can say that in Russia, Vladimir Putin is the ultimate decision maker. So Sergei Lavrov is an experienced diplomat and foreign minister, but he cannot, I think, fill the shoes of Vladimir Putin, nor will he attempt to do that, given Putin's participation by video.
That was Misha Gutkin, managing editor of the Russian service in our New York bureau. You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. China's foreign ministry says the country's top diplomat, Wang Yi, will visit three African countries and Turkey in the coming days. The ministry said today that the trip will be wrapped around a high-level BRICS meeting on security affairs in Johannesburg from July 24th to the 25th. South Africa is the current chair of BRICS, which includes Brazil, Russia, India, and China. A summit of the bloc's leaders will take place next month. Wang's visit to Africa comes as Beijing seeks to bolster its presence on the continent. Foreign Minister Qin Gang visited Africa last year on his first overseas visit in the job. VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number +1202-258-3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a report we did that mattered to you. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa, or tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. That number, again, is +1 202-258-3076. Tell us your name and where you live, and you might hear your comments on our shows. And thanks for 60 years of support. The Women's Soccer World Cup kicks off in New Zealand and Australia tomorrow. More than a million tickets have already been sold for the 64 games. FIFA, the sports international governing body, believes it will be the most watched women's soccer tournament. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
32 nations will take part in the World Cup, co-hosted by Australia and New Zealand. In 1991, when the event was first held, there were just 12 teams. The United States is the defending champion and hopes to become the first team to win the trophy three times in a row. With matches as far apart as Perth in Western Australia to the New Zealand capital Wellington, this tournament will be like no other in terms of distances. Ireland, for example, will travel 8,000 kilometres in the group stage alone. But as the tournament prepares to start, there is controversy over the competition's prize money. The winners of the Men's World Cup receive $440 million, but for women, the prize is $110 million. The Australian women's national team, known as the Matildas, released a video Monday to complain about the disparity and lack of an equal prize. Midfield player Tamaki Yallop said while the Matildas have some of the same rights as Australia's men's team, the Socceroos, there's still inequality.
Collective bargaining has allowed us to ensure we now get the same conditions as the Socceroos, with one exception. FIFA will still only offer women one quarter as much prize money as men for the same achievement.
Soccer is Australia's most popular sport in terms of participation. There's a feeling among former players and supporters that New Zealand and Australia are hosting the tournament at a pivotal time for women's football. Its profile has never been higher, and arguably the standards never better. Kate Gill is a former Matildas captain and co-chief executive at Professional Footballers Australia, the Players' Union. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that she hopes the tournament will encourage fans to also support Australia's domestic competitions.
There's going to be a number of young boys and girls that are really going to fall in love with the game and want to get involved in football. And we do have two domestic codes, both the A-League men and the A-League women. They are crying out for some love in that respect. So if we could kind of transition that enthusiasm and fans could start showing up in support of that, I think that would be the big call out from this World Cup.
The highest-ranked country going into the World Cup is the United States, followed by Germany, Sweden, England and France. Co-hosts Australia are ranked 10th by FIFA, while New Zealand is 26th. The opening match will be between New Zealand and Norway at Eden Park in Auckland on July 20. A few hours later in Sydney, Australia plays Ireland. The final will take place in Australia a month later at Sydney's Olympic Stadium on August 20. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Zainab Abdelrahman, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. What whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.